Thanks. It is good to be here. You know, Ben made a reference about Jehovah's Witnesses for Halloween, and Ben and I did a presentation where we had to dress like Jehovah's Witnesses in seminary.
That was an Easter egg for you.
Thank you. The other piece of information is last Monday I did a college tour with my daughter, who's a senior in high school at USC. I may need some forgiveness for some of the underbreath comments I made there. Actually, she loved it, and it was very nice. It was very nice. So I, for a long time, followed my grandmother's advice to stay away from religion and politics, that they were not polite conversation. In fact, my work has focused primarily on religion and race in the history of the United States, and more recently on new religious movements. So I came into religion and presidential politics sort of through the back door. When Barack Obama was first running for the nomination in 2008, he was taking a lot of flack for the church where he worshiped, and Jeremiah Wright was the pastor there. Do you remember that? And I did a little writing about that and then got asked to teach a class about that. And I thought, well, that's a one-off thing, and I can go back to my other stuff and ignore religion and politics again. And then a Mormon decided to run against Obama in 2012, and I do a lot of writing about Mormonism, and so I had to teach that class, and Ben actually helped me with a little article I did about that election, and I thought, well, okay, now I'm really done. And I'm not teaching about it this year because of my administrative position, but I am still certainly engaged in what's going on. So that's sort of how I come to this, not as an expert, but sort of someone through the back door. I'm also a historian, as I mentioned, and so I'm actually interested in the past. I like writing about dead people because they do not talk back. or sue me, yes, right. But nonetheless, I think history has some at least contextual things to say about what's going on. You know, as I mentioned in worship this morning, on the one hand, this election seems really peculiar and different and unique, and I think that's true. But as I also suggested, I actually think in the long view of history, maybe not quite so much. I think as human beings, as imperfect human beings, we have a tendency to think highly of the moment that we are in. And I think when we see things in the long train of things, it's not always that special. So, for example, despite our angst about the rhetoric in this election, as you may have heard, we have had elections where the rhetoric that the candidates and their supporters have thrown against each other has been as bad or worse, going all the way back to 1800 between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, and a number of elections, 1824, 1876, 1884, lots of elections where the rhetoric would be quite surprising to you. The bad words they use are different than the bad words we use now. But even that that piece of it. But what I want to suggest to you then is that this was my argument at least until 2 weeks ago. And this was actually my argument coming out of the 2012 election, and that is that religion is playing an increasingly smaller and less significant role in presidential politics and presidential elections. And I still think that's true, but I'm going to keep, as historians are wont to do, nuancing and contradicting myself as I make that larger argument along the way. A little bit of back and forth. As we think about that then, and do look primarily at the near term, I just want to point out that, in fact, a lot of the dynamics that we take for granted in terms of the relationship between religion and presidential elections are fairly recent developments in and of themselves. For example, the close examination of a president's faith is not something that has, in the history of the country, been that central to presidential elections. Assuming alliances between conservative Christians, evangelicals, and the Republican Party is something that only dates back to about 1979. Some of you may remember that decade. The evangelical vote was a highly contested vote, such as it was before that. And even the association of religion with conservative social issues and conservative politics is a fairly recent development, right? In the 1950s and 1960s, the primary social movement, the civil rights movement, was a movement of progressive Christianity. Right, so these associations that we have, I think, and even I might add, the anti-abortion movement up until the 1970s was actually more closely linked with the Democratic than the Republican Party, because of the role of Catholics as a base in the Democratic Party. So a lot of the things that I think that we assume to have just always been there, in fact, are fairly recent models. And in fact, in many ways, the engagement of religion and politics, evangelicals and particularly fundamentalists sat out much of the 20th century. Jehovah's Witnesses are not politically engaged. So models of the relationship between religion and politics have, for much of our country's history, and certainly even in the mid-20th century, been one of disengagement rather than engagement. As we think about, as I sort of make this argument that I'm going to occasionally undermine about the declining importance of religion in politics or in presidential elections, the breaking down of that pattern, or the pattern that is being broken down, is not a very old pattern in and of itself. And so I think it's helpful to keep that in mind. One other caveat from the really long historical view, and that is lamenting the decline of religion, by which we mean Christianity in American history, has been happening from the moment the Puritans stepped off the boat in 1620. They have been lamenting. And so in some ways, that sort of rhetoric is itself both a cliche and quintessentially American. All right, so here's the basic plan. We'll see if I can stick to it. In general, the way that we have thought about religion and politics in the United States is to look at the religious identity of the candidates, to look at the patterns of voters by religious identity, and then look at religious issues. And so I want to follow that basic pattern, and at least until 2 weeks ago, I gave this talk at my own church. Well, not this talk, because I've had to change it, but spoke on this topic about 6 weeks ago. And a lot has changed in the last 6 weeks, I think, in the way that I have thought about this, or at least I've changed some of my assumptions. But let's start with the candidate's faith. So in laying out that outline, I should say I'm not going to talk about a lot of things that you probably want to hear about, and I'm going to leave you with a lot more questions than answers. That's a successful class in my mind. So if I've aggravated you or left you wanting, then I've done my job. So the candidate's faith. This has been actually sort of the first and foremost of the ways that we have talked about religion and politics in presidential elections, going back quite a ways. And that is somewhat of an irony, because the only mention of religion in the Constitution, that is before you get to the Bill of Rights, in fact explicitly prohibits any sort of religious test for someone holding public office. This is the only time the word religion appears in the Constitution before the First Amendment, right? But we have always had, or have long had, an unofficial religious test, right? That is, that the voters, the electorate, as if that's some monolith, have nonetheless preferred or even insisted upon candidates who have professed not only religious but Christian, and not only Christian but Protestant Christian faith, for the most part, right? 1928, the candidacy of Al Smith, his Catholicism was a major issue in that. And of course, in 1960, it was for JFK as well, though unlike Al Smith, JFK was able to transcend that difference, but not without having to take it head on in the belly of the beast, speaking to Southern evangelicals in Houston, Texas. Since Kennedy in 1960, we've seen both increased attention to the faith of the candidates and a gradual broadening of what is an acceptable form of Christian faith. 1976, Jimmy Carter is the first evangelical, declared the year of the evangelical, and the media was stumbling over themselves to figure out what this evangelical and born-again thing was all about. Is it a cult? They wondered. Michael Dukakis is a Greek Orthodox candidate in 1988. By 2004, John Kerry's Catholicism was not an issue as a major party nominee. Then in 2008, Obama coming from the Black Church, a tradition that was unfamiliar to many, and then finally Mitt Romney's Mormonism in 2012. So we've had this gradual broadening of the acceptable forms of Christianity that a candidate might have. Now we seem to have a rather sudden departure from this informal religious test, with the candidacy of Donald Trump. What's especially noteworthy in Trump's primary run is that the candidates he defeated in the Republican primary were overtly religious, right? They fit the pattern, and yet he defeated them quite easily. That is that to say, Trump's lack of Christian credentials was neither a secret nor a detriment to his run to the nomination and marked a rather sudden shift away from the informal religious test that a candidate demonstrates some nominal form of Christianity. Now, I assume I'm among friends here, so I'm not going to, you know, walk the balance beam as carefully as I do elsewhere. So, you know, this is especially striking for a Republican candidate where the Christian expectations have been higher than for Democratic candidates and for the primary. And I would argue that, in fact, primaries are where this plays out more significantly, actually, than in the general election. That's where both Obama and Romney's religious affiliations, for example, were the biggest issue, was in the primaries and not in the general election. So Trump's claims of being Presbyterian notwithstanding, and despite some amusing half-hearted attempts to suggest that he was 2 Corinthians, putting money in the communion bread plate as it was passed at a Presbyterian church just before the aisle, actually in the congregation of a classmate of Ben and mine's from seminary. He nonetheless seems to have maintained the typical Republican hold over evangelical voters. Well, maybe until the last couple of weeks. And again, you see here, this is nobody. Now, if you can't read the small print on these, don't worry. That's not the main point. I'm going to give you where I got all this from at the end. I just want you to be able to sort of get the gist of the larger bars. And that is sort of the farther to the right the blue is, the more religious the candidates were seen. And you can see Ben Carson way up top, 80%. Donald Trump at the bottom, 44%. And this was way back in January of 2016, right? So Republican voters are not fooled. Trump has not been tricking anybody to think that he really is a Christian. And he's won in spite of that. And that's the significance, right? I do think it's worth pausing briefly to talk about Trump's religious biography. He actually, first as a child, attended a small Presbyterian church, a very old one in Jamaica, Queens, New York. It's now a very diverse, it's a very brown congregation. It was not when he was there. But most of his church attendance has been at the Marble Collegiate Church in New York City. It includes where he married his first wife, where he met his second wife and married her as well. Its pastor, Norman Vincent Peale, and by the way, the Collegiate Church is a very old church, precedes the really back to the English foundations of New York City in the 17th century. It's part of the Reformed Church in America. That's a kissing cousin to we Presbyterians. So it's in this Reformed, dare I say, Calvinist tradition to which we belong, just the Dutch version of it. Its pastor of the Marble Collegiate Church, Norman Vincent Peale, right? Power of Positive Thinking. You may be familiar with this. He was there for about 50 years in the middle 20th century, and in fact performed Trump's first marriage. And Norman Vincent Peale, in a really unfair generalization, right? This is the, you know, sort of, if you think it'll happen, you just have to have happy thoughts. That's totally unfair, but for our purposes, it will work here. Well, maybe it's not completely unfair, but the point I want to make is that, in fact, that sort of thinking lays the foundation for the prosperity gospel, right? And Trump's sort of, particularly within the African-American tradition, Trump's primary religious support has come from those in the prosperity gospel tradition, which is this idea that God wants you to be rich, and if you just believe, pray, work, and give me enough money, you too will be rich. Again, not completely fair, but kind of. So I think there is, and Norman Vincent Peale attracted sort of the creme la creme of corporate America in Midtown Manhattan in the middle of the 20th century. So I think there is something to note in that that's where his religious backing was. But back to this election now. You know, it's not as if Trump turned his back on religion or religious leaders as a presidential candidate. He made the rounds to all the leading evangelical groups and evangelical leaders, as one must do in the Republican Party. But again, lip service aside, nobody is genuinely or persuasively claiming that he is one of them. And most of the time, Trump doesn't even try. Again, the bottom line is, and it doesn't matter. And this is different. And he doesn't even use religious language or religious or religious imagery. Right? That is, we might, in our armchair theological, psychological analysis, question the faith or beliefs or sincerity of any number of presidential candidates. I think that is probably not a useful exercise. But previous presidents and candidates have used religiously or religiously inspired language about the United States. A city on a hill, 1,000 points of light, articulating a notion of a common good or a shared vision. And Trump doesn't even use that sort of language. The one exception to that might be, and again, something that is occurring all the more in the last few weeks, is he does use the language of good and evil, of an impending apocalyptic destruction, though he doesn't frame it in that religious language. That's kind of a big word for him. I am among friends here, right? But he does very much frame this as an election between good and evil, with sort of eternal consequences, heading down a path from which there is no return. And I did see yesterday, as I was trying to brush up on my charts and graphs, Americans agree in the sense that 74% of people think that there is a great deal at stake in this election. And that's about 25% more than was true in the early 2000s. So voters do also see this as a significant election. And so Trump's securing of the nomination seems to indicate that the unofficial religious litmus test for candidates has ended. I think we're a long ways from an avowed atheist being elected president. I can't imagine anyone standing up and saying, I don't believe in God, and getting elected, getting the nomination. So you know, keep that in mind. But in this election, it does seem that the significance of a candidate's religion is far less than it used to be, and that the bar of religiosity that a successful candidate must clear is getting ever lower. Now, another interesting caveat here is that that low bar does seem to be uniquely granted to Trump. There's a lot of surveying that shows for everybody else that standard still holds, but they're going to cut him some pass. And this is an interesting graph here. Now, this, again, comes from the same time as that preview one at the beginning of a Republican primary nomination. But the question here is, even if a candidate is not religious, would they make a good president? So it's explicitly saying, take in mind what you understand about the religiosity of this candidate, and do you think they'd be a candidate, a good president? Right? The last one just sort of was about them. And Trump, 56%. Right? And what's that, 28 plus? So almost 50% of people are saying, yeah, we know he's not religious, but they're saying he'd still be a good president. So there's people are explicitly acknowledging this lack of religiosity on the part of Trump and still noting their enthusiasm for him. All right? More recently, evangelicals in particular have been quite explicit that unlike in elections for presidents past or unlike for presidents past, they are no longer concerned about the personal morality of a candidate. Right? And that's a dramatic change from the rhetoric coming out of the religious right from 20 years ago. You may remember a certain impeachment episode. Right? So you know, 30% in 2011, right? This is a big change. So the top bar here is 2011. The bottom bar is 2016. Are you willing to write off the personal behavior of a presidential candidate? Only 30% of evangelicals said so in 2011. 72% said so in a survey not that long ago. All right. So that does mark a significant change. A couple weeks ago, not even that, 10 days ago, Ben Carson was speaking with Morning Joe on MSNBC, said, "Sometimes you put your Christian values on hold to get the work done." Right? This is a significant shift in rhetoric, particularly from the right, about the role of religion and presidential candidates. Where, you know, Ralph Reed and James Dobson argued that, in fact, these sorts of things were of paramount importance, and now, quote, issues are superseding them. As one evangelical theologian said, yes, it is moral evil to commit adultery. It is also morally wrong to approve of committing adultery. But that does not mean that it is morally evil to vote for someone who has committed adultery. And this dovetails well with the sermon this morning, and we did not plan this. In a world affected by sin, voting for morally flawed people is unavoidable. Voting for the candidate you think will be best for the country or do the least harm to the country is not a morally evil action, so this objection does not apply. Right? So Trump is an easy and fun candidate to mock from the perspective of faith, but the important point is that it doesn't seem to matter. And I do think that that is a change. Now, this is true of Hillary Clinton as well, though from the exact opposite angle. Despite a lifelong commitment to the Methodist tradition of her childhood, she gets no benefit and she gets no boost, even though she has been quite explicit about the ways that her Christian faith has informed her public life over the course of her entire career. Clinton grew up in a Methodist church in Chicago, Parkway's United Methodist Church, where a youth minister, Don Jones, emphasized with the youth group social justice. He took them to hear Martin Luther King Jr., to visit inner city Chicago churches, and introduced Clinton to the writings of theologians such as Bonhoeffer, Niebuhr, and Tillich. From that upbringing, she embraced a social gospel and social justice perspective to care for the less fortunate and to make the world a better place, crediting the Methodist magazine Move from shifting her politics from the right to the left. She went to Wellesley as a Goldwater girl in the early 60s, and so moved politically during her time there and credits her reading this Methodist magazine that her youth pastor was sending her for that shift. Clinton devoted the entire chapter, and this is not new. This language and story is in no way new. In her first book, It Takes a Village, she devoted an entire chapter to the importance of faith. And in a 1993 profile, the First Lady was noted that her liberalism was derived from her religiosity. In her memoir, Hard Choices, she says her choices to enter electoral politics and later to leave the Senate and accept President Obama's invitation to become Secretary of State were prompted by the Wesleyan mantra, do all the good you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as you ever can. In short, Clinton depicts her entire career in public service as a means of putting her faith into action. And I will say that Clinton also interacted with and engaged with evangelicals during her time in Washington, reflecting also a conservative religious influence, which her mother was sort of the progressive side and her father was the conservative side, and her teachers and youth leaders actually sort of warred over the souls of these children in this church. And that sort of conservative influence was concerned about overdoing the social gospel at the expense of spirituality. Hillary Clinton even joined the Bible study of the Fellowship, and if you want to know about that, your pastor knows a great deal about that group, in a Senate prayer breakfast. And those influences led her to part ways from more progressive voices in her church over issues and her party, such as religious liberty, the Iraq War, and the Defense of Marriage Act. Clinton taught Sunday school and delivered guest sermons on Methodism as the First Lady of Arkansas. And in Washington, D.C., Hillary and Bill Clinton were more faithful in church attendance than any family in recent, first family in recent memory except the Carters. And in choosing Foundry Methodist Church, the Clintons followed Hillary's denominational affiliation rather than Bill's, which was Southern Baptist. Yet most people know more about Trump's lack of religiosity than they do Hillary's long involvement. And this dimension does not affect her candidacy. In August 2007, 53% of Americans thought Clinton was religious or very religious. And 24% thought she didn't know. That she wasn't, and another quarter didn't know. So half said she was religious, a quarter not, and a quarter not know, roughly. In January 2016, so when she began her second run for the presidency, that had dropped from 53 to 48% of the electorate thinking she was religious, and 43% thought she was not. So most of those, a good chunk of that undecided group, or don't know group, was now convinced, in fact, that she was not religious. That is a most stark among the GOP, but the tendency is true to think that way across the electorate. So in the end, she neither gets credit nor is punished for her religiosity, though interestingly, at one point, Trump did briefly try to invoke this unofficial religious test by questioning her faith. We don't even know what it is. We don't even know what she is. But as that has often been the case, Trump was not letting facts get in the way of his fear-mongering. He simply didn't know the facts, and the issue has not arisen again. Again, this is a departure from the past where religious convictions have been more important. And you can see that in this chart here. The top is the number of Americans who think that it's important for a president to have strong religious faith. And the bottom is the line of those who disagree. And this goes from 2000 to 2016. And you can see that 70% of people in 2000 of Americans thought it was important that a president have strong religious beliefs, and that has declined to 62% in 2016. Not huge, but it's a significant movement, and particularly 35% of Americans are now saying, yeah, they don't think it's important. Another way to look at this is to look at the more recent trend, and that is from 2008 to 2016, that has dropped by 10%. That's a really rapid shift in what's going on. Yeah. I'm afraid we're going to get off if we do that, so maybe if we could hold those, unless there's something that's not clear on that. So what the point I want to make here is that, well, it's easy to see this sort of morality doesn't matter or religiosity doesn't matter for Trump, that in fact pattern has been emerging over the last couple of elections. So it's not immediate here in this particular election. So there does seem to be some longer term trend underway even before this peculiar election that we're in, which is a larger argument that I think that I would make. I think this election, because of its peculiarity, has surfaced some things. But they are mostly things that were already in process. They're not new things. It's just made them more visible and more sudden than they might otherwise be. So we've had, at least since 2008, a decline in the religiosity of candidates. Okay, so that's decline in presidential things. Let's look briefly now at voters and religious affiliation. I'm trying to correct that mainstream media anti-religion bias here. Before we get into the particular ways that religious groups vote, it's important to look at what religious demographics are like. And this is a rapidly changing area in the United States that simply between 2007 at the very top here, between 2007 and 2014, which is the last time we have really good statistics, the number of people who identify as Christians has dropped by almost 8%. That's a lot, fast, in the history of the United States. And of course, the fastest growing group in the United States is the unaffiliated, or the religious nuns. And where I work at Santa Clara University, a Jesuit Catholic institution, we have to clarify that's N-O-N-E-S and not N-U-N-S. So thank you. So this is a decline in the number of Christians, both relative and absolute, in the United States, according to recent surveys. And for the first time, no specific religious group can claim over 50%. That is, Protestant Christianity, the largest clump when we start to break down Christianity, has now dropped a few percentage points below 50% itself. So we have a plurality, but no majority. And that's a very significant change in the religious landscape. As recently as 1974, 63% of Americans identified as Protestant and another 25 as Catholic. So according to my quick math, that's 88% of Americans in the mid-70s were identifying as Christians. So still predominantly Christian now, but looking very different. And even that continuity, still 70% of Christian, masks a lot of changes that are happening underneath the surface there. American Christians, like the U.S. population as a whole, are becoming more racially and ethnically diverse. Non-Hispanic whites count for smaller shares of evangelical Protestants. There are fewer white Protestant Christians and Catholics in all of these groups. African-American Protestants actually are holding fairly steady. And so there is very much a racial dimension to this, which I hope I have time to come back to. For much of American history, to be American meant to be religious and Christian and white and Protestant. And now it may not mean any of those things. And those who are Christian, and particularly those who are white Christian, are older. Present company excluded, of course. 7 out of 10 older white Americans are Christian, and only 3 out of 10 younger are. It's important to note that, in fact, virtually every group except African-American Protestants is declining. That includes evangelicals, and that's a story that is often not as fast as the mainline, but the evangelicals are shrinking as well. So here's kind of a visual representation of this. You have at the top Protestant, in the middle Catholic, and at the bottom unaffiliated, and you can see how these lines, this is from 1974 up to 2014, how these lines are converging on each other, and particularly unaffiliated and Catholic are at the same point now. But the Protestant line is the significant slope in decrease there. So in electoral terms, just over the last 24 years, since 1992, the last time a Clinton was elected, the first time as a Clinton was elected, I think we can probably safely say now, white Christians as a portion of the electorate has declined from 73 to 55%. So white Christians are barely in total a majority of what's going on there. Lots of reasons for that. We can go into them if there's time, but that's the fact. All right, Catholics. Catholics are experiencing the greatest net losses, which was a surprise to me when I came into this in this election season. And some of the facts about this loss may surprise you. Almost 32% of Americans identify as being raised Catholic. And of that group, almost half of them no longer identify as Catholic. So if you crunch the numbers, that means that 13% of Americans identify as former Catholics, or as we often joke on my campus, recovering Catholics. Now, there's all kinds of studies about changes in affiliation and people moving, and that used to be what happened religiously. But if you look at net gains and losses, Catholics are coming out the worst. They're losing people, but they're gaining very, very few. So whereas some other traditions are able to make up for those losses by gains, Catholics have not been successful in doing that. The only thing that's keeping Catholics even where they are at this point is immigration of Hispanic and Latino Catholics. But even that is not enough to stop the decline. And it had been up until the beginning of this decade. Perhaps the most noteworthy story is, in fact, the rise of the nuns. So we have seen really significant jumps in the number of unaffiliated in this century, but particularly dramatic if we go back to 1990. It used to hover around 5%, a little bit above. Now we're at about 20% of people who are religiously unaffiliated. This makes up atheist, agnostic, nothing in particular, spiritual but not religious, all of that group. And I think part of what's significant about that, we used to say, well, the number of atheists and agnostics is holding pretty low at around 5%. And the rest of that group is spiritual but not religious. But that's not so true anymore. People are more stridently unaffiliated and uninterested than they were even 8 to 10 years ago in how they answer these questions. We still don't know a lot about them, but that's what they're telling us. They are young, as I mentioned, and they have become the largest, if you break it down into microgroups, sort of political voting bloc in the United States. They were the largest religious source of support for Obama in both elections, but particularly in 2012. So it's a national change as well. I think we tend to think of New England, West Coast, and Northwest as centers of the nuns, but in fact, we're seeing significant growth in all regions of the country, certainly more in the West in New England than elsewhere, but in the South, 6%, 19% of the total electorate, even in the South, for the religiously unaffiliated. So this is a national and not a regional event of what's going on. Here in the West, the religiously unaffiliated are more numerous than Catholics, evangelicals, and every other religious group. All right, so let's, real quickly, you see non-Christian faiths, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, and others are the other groups that are growing. Not by a lot. They're not significant portions of the U.S. Population, but they are groups that are on a slight, at least, upward trajectory. All right. Okay, so let's now look at voting patterns by religious affiliation. Who are the most loyal Republican voters? Guesses? Evangelicals, but Mormons are number one in terms of loyalty to the Republican Party. That may change. So that's the red up at top, right? And then the next groups are evangelical. Most loyal Democratic voters. Yeah, the good student is sitting in the front here. He can also read the print. Yeah, African-American Protestants, some like 98% loyalty to the Democratic Party, and then the nuns that we're talking about. So those are our extremes, right? Mainline Protestants tend to lean a little bit Republican, and Catholics are right in the middle. They basically go the way of the nation. So certainly the most common and pervasive political religious association is between white evangelicals and Republicans. As I mentioned at the beginning, we often forget that this is a fairly recent development. It happened in the late 1970s. It's a point that is often taken for granted. It's not always been. It was not always inevitable. Contrary to popular belief, it did not come about because of abortion, but because of segregation. And once that particular movement awakened the beast, then they identified in a conference call to which the scholar Randy Balmer was a witness, the decision, hey, what about abortion? And the rest is history, as they say. All right, so now what about this election? What do we see going on? Well, there's my evangelical Republican picture. That's Reagan saying to an National Association of Evangelicals, I know you can't endorse me, but I endorse you. And that's sort of a seminal moment in securing that right. The religious right has been credited with electing Reagan to office following their disillusionment with Jimmy Carter's form of evangelicalism. Heading into October, Trump seemed to be doing even a little bit better than Romney among white evangelical voters. So he had about 78% to Romney's 73%. This is, I think, in June, yeah. So he'd gotten the nomination by that point. So that seemed to be holding course for Trump Republicans and evangelicals. Though we don't have good polling on what's happened with evangelicals in particular over the last couple of weeks. So one of the things voters, evangelical voters, tell us is they think that Trump understands them, understands people like them. Apparently, they've never seen pictures of his Manhattan penthouse apartment.
Right,
right. 61% of evangelical voters say that about him, while just 24% say that about Clinton. Now, what's interesting, and you may have heard this, right? One of the interesting dynamics of what's going on here is, in fact, these are people voting for Clinton, Trump over Clinton, sorry. 45% are voting against Clinton with their vote for Trump. This is sort of evangelical Protestants, right? And only 30% of evangelical Protestants are actually voting for Trump. So more people are voting against Clinton than for Trump. And even among evangelicals who are voting for Clinton, that tiny blue to the side there, the same is true, right? 10%, so she has 16% evangelical support. 10% of those are voting against Trump, and only 6% are voting for her. So I think that suggests a certain fragility in evangelical support for Trump, even before the developments of last week, that in fact he does not receive support intrinsically for himself, but he's riding a wave of opposition. I think it's important to suggest, though I have not read a lot of studies of this, that feminism has a very uncomfortable place in evangelicalism. So merely the notion of a woman running for president is problematic in conservative evangelical associations, even before her last name is Clinton. Now, I think it's also worth pointing out that, in fact, this pattern of voting against a candidate rather than for a candidate is not a departure from the last election. You may recall the animosity that, in fact, Obama created among Republicans. Kind of hard to remember now how visceral that opposition was. That, in fact, and Romney's Mormonism also factoring in there. So that for Romney, 23% of his supporters, evangelical supporters, said, in fact, they were not voting for him but against Obama. So this is not a new, entirely new pattern. And in the spirit of fairness, Democrats say the same thing, right? They frame their vote for Clinton as one against Trump, particularly among the nuns. And that is a bit of a break from Obama. Democrats in general and nuns in particular were much more positive in their support for Obama than merely opposing Romney. So that voting for Clinton as a vote against Trump, that level of doing so is fairly new. So that overall, this is interesting, over half of registered voters say they're not voting for a candidate but against one. Yeah. And it was only about a third in the last election. It is worth pointing out that this lack of enthusiasm is hardly a lack of engagement or sense of entertainment in this year's election cycle. That evangelical vote was starting to break down even before the developments of a couple weeks ago with the Hollywood Access tape. A number of evangelical leaders had come out against Trump. Trump, in other words, has divided evangelicals in a way that no previous candidate had since that alliance first emerged in the late 1970s. I think it's interesting to note who those supporters for Trump are. Terry Perkins, Jerry Falwell Jr., Ralph Reed, Gary Bauer, Robert Jeffress, Franklin Graham, and Eric Metaxas. For the most part, these are has-beens. These are old white guys, right? Opponents of Trump. And please don't confuse opponents for Trump with supporters of Clinton. Those are different things. But opponents of Trump include Russell Moore of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. That's a very prominent, soapbox for Southern Baptists. He's a younger, because his predecessor was an old white guy who got kicked out for saying things, inappropriate racial things. Al Mohler, president of Southern Baptist Seminary, So some prominent Southern Baptists, in fact, have come out against Trump. And in fact, after the tape was released last week, and I think it's worth pointing out that it was only after the tape and the attack on women, not the attack on immigrants, not the attack on Muslims, you know the rigmarole, that this is finally what pushed it over, which I think has to do with constructions of gender and female gentility. They're in themselves problematic, but another talk for another time. Al Mohler of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary called Trump a crisis of conscience, an excruciating crisis, the personification of what evangelicals have preached and voted against. So this is a very prominent Southern Baptist saying that under any normal circumstances, Trump would be the realization of evangelical nightmares and not a carrier of evangelical hopes. He calls him a horrifying embarrassment. Can you tell I'm having fun with this? A price too high to pay for any political gain that might come. They are not wrong to see Hillary as a threat to evangelical values, those who support Trump, but they are wrong, I believe, to serve as apologists for Donald Trump. And it's interesting to note that as people were running from Trump as fast as they could a couple weeks ago, who are the people that stood most fiercely by him? They were old, white, male evangelical leaders, far and away the most vocal group standing up for Trump after the recent developments. Mohler then says, I think, in a very observant comment, that in retrospect, evangelicals invested far too much hope in elections and presidential candidates. In other words, they were after power and not after theology, and that has finally called them onto the carpet. He goes on to say, not only is Trump disqualified from being a Sunday school teacher, honest evangelicals would not want him as a next door neighbor. I could read this stuff all day. He's beyond redemption. He doesn't know how to confess, loudly or quietly. Right? He's not even the publican or the Pharisee, you know, shouting out. He's already undermined the plausibility of any conversion or contrition at this point, right? There has been an increasing voice against here. And that was emerging before the last 2 weeks, but it has accelerated, possibly severing the link between evangelicalism and a particular party. So it hasn't happened, but we are seeing steps in that direction. Particularly as sort of new leaders come up, young evangelicals don't share the same perspective as younger evangelicals. They're not particularly concerned about gay marriage. They think the climate is changing, right? Older evangelicals think there are sort of these line in the sand issues that younger evangelicals just don't care about. So that, again, there's a real age disconnect. And while evangelical numbers are declining, again, the nuns are coming up. We've seen particularly a shift in evangelical women's support, right? A large number, and even more so in the last couple of weeks, have come out in favor of Clinton. So I think this is a big piece of the story. It's a big piece of the story because whereas there has been a gender gap in voting, right, Democrats win women easily and Republicans win men easily over the last several elections, there has not been a gender gap among evangelicals. Men and women in the evangelical tradition have tended to vote in the same way for Republican candidates. That appears it will not be the case in this election. That is a significant shift, and a number of commentators have suggested that, in fact, evangelical women have a far bigger audience and influence than these old white guys. So this, I think, really leads to one of the big questions of the election. Is this rift among evangelical voters in the Republican Party a temporary hiccup, or is it, in fact, a premonition of permanent change? All right, the nuns, right? A bedrock of support for Obama in both of his election, and they're pretty consistently holding to form this time around. They are lining up behind Clinton over Trump, as they did in the past. Two-thirds of religiously unaffiliated voters before the events of the last 2 weeks said they would vote for Clinton if the election were held today, which is almost exactly what they were in 2012. Now, the thing to know about religious nuns is they're kind of politically apathetic. In 2012, they were 20% of the public, but only 12% of people who voted. Evangelicals were 20% of the public and 26% of those who voted, right? So a pretty significant, you know, from an even place, you have, what, a 14% swing there between them. One quarter of unaffiliated voters are not registered to vote. Now, I would suggest to you that this is less a fact of their religious identity than of their age, right? Because this is a demographic that skews young, and that fits the voting patterns and practices of younger people. All right, Catholics. Donald Trump has a massive Catholic problem. Historically, over the last century, Catholics have voted as the nation votes. In other words, either they don't tell us very much, or if you're putting money on the election, put it where the Catholics go. But the Catholic split has tended to be exactly the national split. They voted for the winners for most of the last 100 years. That's not the case anymore. That's significant, and especially because Catholics have been a part of this evangelical, Mormon, Catholic coalition that has skewed Republicans or helped Republicans on the national scene. So they're going hugely towards Clinton. They favor her by as much as 17 points. Right? And you can see here how it was a 2-point difference in 2012. So there's almost a 25% swing among many Catholic voters compared to Obama. Now, I should say, if my numbers don't line up, it's not my fault, because polls ask these questions in different ways, and I'm pulling together lots of different polls, but the trends and the tendencies are all the same, and I'm not a mathematician to boot. So, but it is, with one exception, the biggest shift among any demographic, religious or non-religious voting. The biggest shift, white college-educated women moving away from Democrats towards Republicans. White college-educated women shifting towards Democrats away from Republicans. Sorry. It's almost lunchtime, right? But even white Catholics are favoring Clinton over Trump. All right, why might that be? Trump has attacked a very popular pope. It is worth pointing out this is not just Hispanic. Hispanic Catholics have long favored Democratic candidates. As I noted, even white Catholics are favoring Clinton. Trump's character, problematic. His views on immigration, a major Catholic issue, problematic. His secular tendencies, problematic. And among that, evangelical Mormon Catholic Alliance. Catholics has always held the most progressive social views, so they were sort of the most likely that would flee. Frequent mass-going white Catholics, see that? Frequently mass-going white Catholics, see this is the way pollsters try to figure this stuff out. That's Trump's strongest base. So loyal, faithful white Catholics. But they're a shrinking part of Catholicism. Right, as are white Catholics in general. So that part of his base, and I'd say that's true almost across the board religiously, that where Trump and Republican candidates in general are strongest is where the numbers are shrinking. Latino Catholics have long voted Democratic. Given the fact that Catholics are 25% of the electorate, what's happening among Catholics is in fact significant. The Catholic hierarchy has been pretty quiet this time around. I think Trump's shifting views on abortion might be another reason that he's, in fact, not a dependable anxiety for all. He's not a dependable person in terms of his views, right? I mean, I think there's a reluctance to vote on issues for a lot of people because they don't know how he's going to do that. All right, so when you put all these pieces together, what you get is a closing of what's called the God gap. Right? If you look at people's religious affiliation, how different does that play out? Right? There has always been, well, at least since 1980, A preference among more faithful people, more churchgoers, for Republican rather than Democratic candidates. And that God gap seems to have disappeared. And in fact, these Catholic numbers that I've talked about are a big reason why. Because evangelical Protestants, at least for the time that this polling was taking place, were holding steady, as I showed you, for Trump. So you begin to see, you get this closing of the God gap, and Catholics are a huge piece of that. Now, white evangelical women seem to be adding to that over the last couple of weeks. In 2012, for example, Romney won faithful church attenders by 20 points. Now it's even. So that's a huge shift in what's going on there. All right, I'm trying to jump ahead here a little bit, but as I suggested, there do seem to be cracks even in that evangelical piece, which will be interesting to pay attention to. One other piece that I don't have in here is Mormons, right? So that most faithful of Republican voters, and now there's talk that a third party candidate may in fact win Utah, right? So you have this pulling away from Trump. So that's another significant chink in the armor of the religious conservatism and Republican alliance. All right, so let's see where we are. Okay, so we have these shifting demographics, and we have these shifting changes within demographics that suggests that in fact something is going on. And in fact, those changes have been going on for some time, but the particular developments of this election and the Republican candidate in particular seem to have exacerbated the way that those trends are moving. So on the one hand, I want to suggest that in fact this election is not about religion at all. And it's continuing a trend that has been going on for the last several elections. And yet, the last few weeks have convinced me that, in fact, religion is everywhere, even as it is nowhere. So where does this leave us? The votes of white evangelical Protestants, of Catholics, and religious nuns will be very important to the outcome of the 2016 election, considering all these groups are quite large. White evangelical Protestants make up 1/5 of all registered voters in the U.S., and a large part of them skew Republican. Religious nuns constitute another 1/5 of all registered voters, and more than 1/4 of Democratic voters. And Catholics make up yet another 1/5 of the American electorate. So collectively, they have a significant influence. The significance of evangelicals is a constant, at least going back to the late 70s. The significance of the nuns is a recent development, though it certainly carries over from the last two elections. And we may see Catholics not splitting their vote for the first time in generations, though it does seem that they will continue their trend of voting for the winner. Evangelicals have little reason to take heart, as their trajectory is very different than the trajectory of these other two groups. And overall, with the exception of the nuns, it's worth pointing out that religious groups are shrinking, so that any individual group will exert less influence, and appealing to particular religious groups will provide a smaller and smaller political benefit. Now, granted, the nuns are growing, but this is a very diverse group. It's not monolithic. It's not coordinated in any way around that particular religious identity. And so it's very hard to speak to them as a group, since they are really none of the above rather than a particular option. Now, I would have said up until a few weeks ago that I think religion functions as a proxy for other things. I don't think that the way we talk about these religious groups and their religious patterns really tells us what's going on. That these folks are not voting because they're Presbyterian or because they're Catholic or because they're Mormon or because they're none. They're voting for other reasons which may correlate to those identities. Right? And I actually still think that's true. Right? Part of the American narrative is a story about religion, whether it's the Puritans or the power of religious liberty moving here for freedom from religious persecution, to reinscribe that persecution if you're a Puritan, but again, another story for another time. And so we like to tell stories in religious categories. But for the most part, I don't think that's the best way to understand what is going on politically. Correlation is not causation, though it may help us see what's going on, and in fact may help us see what's going to happen even in the future. I think we're missing the mark if we're trying to explain people's behavior. A couple things that I do think are important to note in these correlations, and then I'll be done. One helpful way to understand, I think, the popularity of Donald Trump, even in the last few weeks, and I just read an article on Friday that sort of crystallized this for me, is that it is, in fact, the last gasp of white male evangelical America, right? It's a shrinking group that, in the language of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Stages of Grief, is in denial and anger. And this election and the nomination of Donald Trump is an expression of those particular stages of their grief, right? I would also point out that Christianity has been long implicated in the story of race in the United States, right? And so these things are not disconnected, the racial and the religious elements, right? There has been a long history, here taking the long view again. In fact, if this is true, fits a long pattern in U.S. history of preserving, framing political contests as preserving a white Christian Protestant nation against the threat of outsiders, immigrants, non-whites, and women. Did I leave anybody out? The idea here is that America was founded by and for white Protestant Christians, and it should stay that way. The numbers I've shown you clearly demonstrate that it is not staying that way, and this is a reaction against that. If you think back to Trump's opening campaign statement laced with insults against immigrants, this was a familiar rhetoric to the racist right. And therefore, it's not particularly surprising that groups like the KKK and the alt-right have been vocal supporters of Donald Trump, unlike even some of the religious leaders who have couched and hemmed and hawed and qualified their support as being for other reasons. For these groups, religious nationalism and white supremacy go hand in hand. There's also a gendered dimension to this. In April, the Public Religion Research Institute asked voters, do you agree or disagree with this statement? Society as a whole has become too soft and feminine. The only religious group that correlated a positive response to that question was white evangelical males. So a strong overlap between the views, and not just males, evangelicals in general, but it's more dramatic when I say it that way. A strong overlap between this view and the religious right. So they're the only ones, white evangelical Protestants, 53% agree that society has become too soft and feminine, right? And I should point out, again, this is not new. We see this rhetoric at the beginning of the 20th century. That's why we have the YMCA. It's part of a movement called muscular Christianity. Christian men were becoming too feminine, so we need to get them into the gym, right? And an interesting fact here, recently, this decade, the YMCA formally and officially changed its name to the Y because they wanted to drop the Christian part of that name. So, all right. Yeah. But, you know, slamming, putting Christian up on the sign rarely helps get people into any organization now. It's true. Just look at a lot of churches. All right, so I think these things help to explain sort of the ongoing support that a small subgroup of the American electorate leads them to hang on to their candidate despite damning evidence, more of which emerges almost every day. They see themselves as victims from immigrants, from the gay agenda, from women. And so they need to fight back because both race and masculinity are under attack. One, again, sort of caveat with this is that all these sort of exceptions and qualifications for Trump are just for Trump. If you ask people about a hypothetical race for Congress, all those traditional patterns come back into play, and they're not going to excuse this sort of behavior. So that raises interesting questions about the future and the way the particulars of this election are playing out, and sort of undercuts my larger claim that maybe we're well on our way. But we'll have to see. Certainly for the time being, patterns in polls of religious affiliation may help us predict how the overall election is trending. But like I said, I'm not convinced that there's, in fact, a causation going on here. Basically leave it at that. Summarize my conclusion thoughts that I do think that there is a declining centrality of religion to the way politics is understood and act upon. I don't expect religious tropes, religious language to disappear. It's not like Christianity is disappearing anytime soon. It's still 70% of the United States. But I don't think these changes are a bad thing, because I think the way that it has played out, in fact, there has become an idolatrous relationship between religion and politics in the United States. And I hope that at least my brief allusions to the longer historical context have demonstrated that such alliances are not inevitable. In fact, in 1800, it was a combination of evangelicals and deists, you might as well call them the nuns, that elected Thomas Jefferson to office. Can you imagine a coalition between evangelicals and nuns electing a candidate to office? So I think it does behoove us to think about what the role of religion in an increasingly diverse and secularized nation ought to be. How do we want to, how should we engage with the political arena as communities of faith? How do these things relate to each other? To what extent are American ideals compatible or contradictory with Christian ones? What does it mean to be a Christian in this changing society? And so I think the events of this election are a challenge to us to think about the ways that our own relationship between faith and politics shapes who we are, how we speak, and how we interact with other people. If politics is the art of compromise, can we be both political and Christian, and how? So I will leave it at that. I know that you probably have some things that you might want to talk with. I will just throw this up here to let you know that these two sites are the primary source of my statistics, the Pew Forum and the Public Religion Research Institute. So the charts, the graphs, the numbers that I gave you, almost all of those came from these two sites. I highly recommend them for the best analysis on religion and politics if you want to look at some of this yourself. All right, so we have some time for conversation. Yeah.
I understand Mr. Trump had a born again experience, and I wonder how that affected his market share.
So this was right before the Republican convention, I think. Yeah. James Dobson said he heard that someone said that she heard that he had been born again. And I think that story lasted for about 10 days. And I don't think anybody believed that. I think that was one more piece of evidence how James Dobson is a has-been, how his evidence is not credible. The woman telepreacher, prosperity gospel preacher, who said that he had had that experience. You know, I don't know what it means to have a born-again experience in a prosperity gospel, you know. My profit and my win is going to be huge. That story, I think, never got legitimate traction. It was nice clickbait. It was somebody's desperate attempt. you know, those Jerry Falwell Jr. and Gary Bauer and Terry Perkins and those guys jumped on that. But I think even after a week or two, they couldn't defend that. And nothing in his behavior has demonstrated any evidence. He hasn't changed his demeanor. He hasn't changed his language. You know, Dobson tried to excuse that. Well, he's just a baby. And he's got a baby vocabulary. You've got that right. But if you look at his word count in the debates, but, you know, but he doesn't. No, he hasn't given any language to that that would suggest that. So, yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. here's what I think it will depend upon. I think I don't know about a third party. I think it will depend on what sort of alliance that evangelicals and Republicans pick up from the rubble. And I think it depends on who rises to the top in terms of sort of leading, being the public voices of evangelical Christians. Like I said, I don't think these old guys are going to ever get their market share back. If you look at somebody like Russell Moore, who's I think one of the most prominent older but still respected voices, I think he's very circumspect about the relationship between people of faith and a particular religious party. So I think my guess is that I think they will be kind of gun shy, or you will hear on November 9th who their candidate is. But I think what happens depends on how quickly they try to reestablish that alliance. And I think there's going to be a struggle for power within the evangelical movement to lead the efforts to either build or permanently destroy that alliance. So I don't know, but I think that's what has to be considered, yeah.
What you said sort of fits into an office actually going to happen.
Yeah, well, and I read something interesting, too, that's saying, so look, you have all these female evangelical leaders coming towards Clinton, some before, some after the tape was released a couple of weeks ago, but particularly the people who have moved in the last couple of weeks are really responding as women and not as evangelicals, right? That the experience they're saying, you know, I know what she's talking about. I've been harassed. I've been assaulted. I've been objectified, right? Those are not distinctly evangelical experiences. Those are female experiences. And so that has created this space for her to move in.
With the shift in.
Yeah, so the polling that we have is in a hypothetical race, so not named particulars. I think the actual polling that we're seeing is creating a fair amount of anxiety about down ballot races. That, you know, we're here, I just on the NPR on the way up this morning. Now, it sounds like there's a very good chance that the Senate may go back to the Democrats. That would suggest that differentiation that I was talking about is not in practice playing out. It's a hypothetical change. And so, and just thinking on the top of my feet here, I think it's easier because that's those contrasting questions. I'll write an exception for Trump but not a hypothetical congressional race, right? It's a lot easier to maintain your ideals in a hypothetical rather than a real situation. So I don't know. How's that? Yeah.
So as I understand it, the impetus for this lecture.
Well, I think the first one is that, in fact, I think religious groups will be less effective and influential in the larger political scale because they're a smaller part of the American landscape and they're more divided than ever. That's one piece. The opposite way to talk about that is there's an opportunity as the big voices, evangelical Protestants, shrink, there is perhaps the opportunity for other voices to emerge. Right? Because if we were to ask any group of people, you know, what religious group is associated with politics, it's not going to be progressive Christians or even mainline Protestants, right? But with the declining influence, and I would say one of the things that I think those who have stood by Trump, particularly over the last few weeks, have done is severely damaged the credibility of evangelical Christians as a whole. And a lot of leaders have said this. It said, look, you are completely undermining the witness of this faith. You are scaring people away from the church, right? And so if that's the case, then, you know, the door may be open to alternative religious voices for people who are looking for those. And given the fact that the nuns are such a diverse and unorganized group, to create new alliances that may transcend religious identities. So, I mean, I think there's fertile ground out there. It's kind of, I think, a mixed hope on what that might be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting that women with religion.
Yeah. Those I'm trying to look up a book here. Darn it, it's not on there. A colleague of mine has just published a book about the religious nuns that delves into the complexity of that. Probably be interesting to have up here. So the gendered piece is interesting. I tried to hit on that a little bit right there at the end. Religious institutions tend to be heavily female as opposed to male, except in their leadership, has always been the case in the United States. These things all kind of correlate to each other in interesting ways. I mean, yeah, you had that question about femininity and religion and mm-hmm. playing all that. Anne?
So I'm wondering if there has been any matter, if they're not a real person.
Just a celebrity kind of, that's a great point. Not that I'm aware of, and I think, you know, I'm trying to think. So Reagan was a movie star before he came in, right? But I mean, just we live in a culture of celebrity now that was not in place then. Of course, she's the one that sort of sealed the deal between evangelicals and conservatives. So, that's.
When Schwarzenegger was elected, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I don't think in California, certainly in statewide office, I don't think religion has been an issue for a very long time. But yeah, no, that's interesting. Given how much we might know about a candidate, someone who's popular before, does that mitigate concern or investigation into that? Yeah.
So I want to honor your time and say that we have time for one more question. So all hands go up.
All right.
Do you know how Presbyterians vote?
No, I don't. But what I can tell you is that mainline Protestants, of which Presbyterians are a part, have typically skewed slightly Republican. Close to center, but slightly right. So I would guess that Presbyterians as a whole follow that. We do not get that sort of granular polling data. We're so hard to find nowadays anyway. I don't know if we're a statistically significant a sampling. But in terms of mainline, that's the way it plays out. So.
That was short. You can do another question.
All right. Yeah, I'm back there.
Would it be possible for you to send your power bet about the
nuns? Yeah, sure. Finding Our Religion is the name of the book. It just came to me. Not really. I'm being somewhat facetious. I mean, I run in the same circles as Ben does. So, I know what's going on, but these are not voices that are being heard in any broad way, I think, in the wider conversation. And when they do, I think we hear them as progressive Christian voices, but I think they're not being heard as Christian voices, they're being heard as progressive voices. Yeah, most of them are gone now. So.